All right, everybody. My name's Harold. I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me good? Thumbs up. All right, fantastic. Well, it's a privilege to be here with you. I'm gonna get out of this gallery. I don't have to look at myself. There we go. And I'm grateful to be here. I'm from St. Louis, Missouri. My sobriety date's April 7th, 1987. My home group is AA on the Rocks here in St. Louis. If you ever come to St. Louis, we would love to host you. We'd love for you to hook up with us and come and see us, and so we can hang out. And if we get a hold of you quick enough, we will put you to work. We will get some mileage out of your sobriety, I can promise you. We also have the International coming here in 2030. This is what this shirt says. I proudly represent. And if you're coming to St. Louis for the International, I encourage you to try to come in a day early on that Wednesday. The block party starts on Thursday night, but that Wednesday we'll have some kind of jubilee here for the pre-party party because we all like to party. And in St. Louis, we do it in fine style. So we'd love for everybody to come and be a part of that. My sponsor's on here. He'll be speaking next. That's Steve L. from Nashville. And so I'm grateful for that. I said, let's flip up a coin to go first. He said, I already did, and I lost. So I'm going first. I guess that's how it works with sponsorship. But thank you, Ralph, and thank you for Woodstock West for the invitation to be here. I'm as involved and excited about being sober today as I've ever been in the 39 years. I've been sober since April 7th, 1987. So I'm grateful for that. Steve and I, we had about 30, 40 hours of planning on what we were going to do. We were going to go back and forth. It was going to be awesome. And Ralph just pulled the rubber out from him. He says, no, this is what we're doing. So all that effort and all the energy just gone. But anyway, and I'm teasing. We did have some ideas, but they quickly got squashed. The group conscience overpowered us. But what I want to talk about in my time today is since we're it's sponsee sponsorship is really just my journey with sponsorship. I've had four sponsors in recovery. Each of them have made a big difference in how my life turned out in different ways. And I just want to share about that and how that's influenced my life and how I sponsor people a little bit and how that all shaped into what it is. And it's not right. It's not wrong. It's just different. We all have our different experiences, but one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic it's not only the bright spot of our lives, but it's the foundation of what we're about. And so I like the format and that's what I want to lead with today. And then I'll just weave parts of my story into that. But I think that's a process that I don't really get to share that often in that kind of chronological order of how that worked out. And I think that's what God's put on my heart to do today. I was introduced to AA in 1979 in the Department of Corrections and in Northern Missouri. And a couple members, five members from Alcoholics Anonymous, brought the message into that space. I can't tell you what I heard with my ears, but I can tell you what I heard with these. Because what I do know about recovery is that newcomers, especially whether they're in a confined space or they're just walking into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in person or they're on a virtual platform like today, is that they listen with their eyes and they think with their feelings. And so how we show up matters. And I think it's on page 105 of Bill C's that there's a little excerpt from one of Bill's messages titled Our Chief Responsibility. And it says, and I'm paraphrasing, but it says, our chief responsibility is to deliver an adequate demonstration of Alcoholics Anonymous to the newcomer. And today, I hope that's what happens on everything we do today. And it's so far, we're off to a great start with Ralph and them kicking it off the way they did. And so thank you for everybody who's leading and serving today on our meeting. But that is so important. And so I couldn't tell you anything I heard with these, but I can tell you everything I heard with these. And I didn't stay sober. I had no desire to stay sober. I did accept a plea bargain. A plea bargain was pretty simple. It was either go back, be charged 2.5 more years where I came from, or go into a space for 30 days, go into treatment for 30 days. Well, I quit school when I was 13, but I had enough math to know that 30 days was a heck of a lot shorter than 2.5 years. So that was an easy transition for me to make that plea bargain. And that was my first exposure to AA in a more formal way, both inside a confined treatment context, but also being taken out to the outside surroundings for AA meetings. And that was my first exposure to AA. I didn't stay sober, had no desire to stay sober, but the seed was planted. Adequate demonstration was given. It's where I returned to 7 years later when I burned my life to the ground. And that did happen in early part of 1987. I was arrested for a 4QWI. A few weeks later, I was playing music. I was a drummer, big chunk of my life, and I was playing music over on the east side of St. Louis, coming home with my bandmates in the back seat of a vehicle, passed out, and we were involved in a pretty horrific accident where everybody in the other vehicle lost their life that night. And getting home from that accident in the wee hours of the morning was something that just really ripped apart my soul, and it just pretty much took it out and cut it in half. And I sit there in one of the most demoralized states I've ever been in my life. But there was nothing between me and King Alcohol, you know, and there's nothing between you whenever you're powerless over. And it's your master, it owns the title to your soul. Then you're going to succumb to it every time, which I did. Within an hour, I was drinking again, only to be arrested a few weeks later for another DWI, felony DWI, same judge, same jurisdiction, parole violation on top of it. So I was in a lot of trouble at that stage of my life. But in a cell, I got on my knees and I said the most honest prayer I've ever said in my life. And it was simply this prayer. I've heard it a million times in AA meetings, and it was, God help me. I don't even know if I can't honestly say that if I said please or not, but it was honest. And from that moment till now, all these years later, 39 plus years later, I never found it necessary to pick up another drink. So I'm forever grateful for that. What I do know, and what all I have to share today, friends, is just what I've seen, what I've heard, what I've experienced. Nothing more, nothing less. I know from my own experience, there's three types of people that come to AA. There's those who make it happen, there's those who watch it happen, and there's those who don't know what's happening at all, right? And I've been all three of those cats. And at this stage of my sobriety, I absolutely had no clue what was going on. I went back to Northern Missouri, where I was at in treatment in 1979 into 80. And I went back for two reasons. One, it was familiar. And two, I was in a whole lot of trouble. That was my only motivation for going. I wasn't looking to be an AA or be sober forever. It wasn't anywhere on the top 500 list. But I went there. In my first Ebby, I mean, and I guess this is how we could frame it. You know, my first Ebby, the first Ebby to really step into my life, wasn't a sponsor in figure. It was just a guy, his name was Gary. He had 2.5 months of sobriety. And he wasn't there to be my sponsor. He wasn't there to take me through the steps at that point. He was there for one purpose, to share not just good news, but it was the best news ever. He was on fire for recovery, even with just 2.5 months of sobriety. I think Bill's got a terminology for it. I think we find it on page 109 of the 12 and 12. He calls it the magnificent reality of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's really what that was. He was on fire for it. And he walked into my room in that, and I just got out of detox. And I had seizures a lot when I was drinking. And I had a really massive seizure while I was in treatment detox. And so it took me a little bit to get out of detox into residential. But he walks into my room and he says, "Hey man," he's got a clipboard in his hand, he's smiling, he's all excited. He says, "Look, you're on the list to go to a meeting tonight. If you want to go." And I'm like, you know, I was caught off guard. I said, "Well, what kind of meeting are you talking about?" He says, "An AA meeting." I said, "Oh man, I'm not interested in that." And he was kind of perplexed by that. It's like, "Well, why are you even here?" You know, pretty much was his attitude. And he said, "Well, you're on a list if you want to go." And I said, "Well, I'm not going." And so he politely left, but he came back a few minutes later and it was beautiful. He opened the door and he stuck nothing but his head in and he looked at me and he says, "Well, do me a favor." And I said, "What's that?" He goes, "Why don't you try real hard to smile and get it over with?" And then he just walked out. And I thought, well, what does that even mean? Nobody's ever said anything like that to me before in my life. It was sarcastic, but it was serious at the same time. But it got me to laugh internally. I laughed. And next thing you know, I had willingness and I had a spirit moving in me that I didn't have minutes before. And the next thing you know, I'm scouring the halls looking for this guy. And I find him finally. And I said, "Hey, man, are you still going to that meeting?" He goes, "Yeah, I'm still going." I said, "Well, man, that is awesome." He goes, "Why is that so awesome?" I said, "Because I want to go with you." He goes, "Man, that's great." And I go, "Why is that so great?" I could tell he was super excited. He goes, "Because you're the only one I could get to go." And I knew I just swallowed the hook, you know, on that path. But he took me to my first meeting. I remember when we got there, he told me two things that really helped me. The first thing he said to me was, "If we're going to go in there tonight, if they would call on you, let's hope they don't call on you. But if they would call on you just say your name is Harold and you're an alcoholic. Don't add anything to it. Don't add anything to it whatsoever. Because we know when you say you're an alcoholic, it has a long definition. We know you probably smoke some of this, huff some of that, drank some of this, and you're from the Ozark Mountains. You probably slept with a few farm animals too." And I thought it got me to laugh. You know, he was winning my confidence. I had no idea what he was doing. I don't know if he even knew what he's doing, but it was definitely God working through him. But I got a good laugh out of it. And I've been Harold the alcoholic ever since. So really good prophetic words he gave for me. But I went into that meeting and I sat down. And if you're new here on this meeting and you, why am I even here? You're wondering why you're even on this Zoom meeting at all, or why you're on this journey. Well, I had the same questions. And I asked the guy sitting next to me before the meeting started, I asked him this question: how long do we have to come here? They look at me kind of perplexed. He goes, "Man, you got to come here until you want to." And I'm thinking to myself, "Man, I don't even want to be here tonight, much less tomorrow night. And I dang sure don't want to be there when I look like you." I didn't say this to him personally, but I'm thinking this inside. And now, 39 plus years later, I look like that guy. But I came back home to St. Louis, and I didn't go to AA. But this Abby character, this Gary in my life, ultimately saved my life because he was persistent. And that's a word that we find in our literature. Lots of strenuous work, persistence, all these kind of adjectives and verbs that they throw at us to work towards the new person. This guy was doing it with before smartphones, before even cell phones. He was calling me on the landline. "Hey man, did you go to a meeting yet?" "No, sir, I did not." "Why?" "I don't know why." And I really couldn't tell him why. I don't know why. I was consumed with the trial that I had coming up in June of 87, and I knew I was going to go back to be incarcerated again. I didn't want to do that. I was trying to avoid that at all costs. That's all I cared about. But he would say things, "Harold, your life depends on it." And I knew that was a true story. I didn't want it to be a true story, but it was. And eventually he got my confidence, and I went to my first meeting. And it was duty and drudgery, friends. I didn't want to be here. I didn't understand what recovery meant. If you gave me a definition, it wouldn't have been a good one if I wrote it out in an essay. It just mean I'm going to be separated from the only thing that's given me relief my entire life. It's the only thing that's dealt with this disconnection that I've suffered long before I ever drank. And you're asking me to step divorce from it and move on in life. And I just couldn't, just as our book would say on page 152, I couldn't picture my life with alcohol. I couldn't picture my life without it. It was a very lonely and dark place and space I was at. I look at the steps, I hear about the message in the rooms, but I'm so full of individualism and secularism and materialism and consumerism and go on down the line. I don't see how my life's ever going to shape into anything. Everything I own was in a plastic bag. You're telling me to put the spiritual ahead of the material. I don't even have any material to put the spiritual in front of, at this stage of my life. So I just couldn't subscribe to the solution that was being offered. And as it's well documented from many of our great communicators way ahead of me, who would say that, the hardest thing any of us ever do is take actions we don't believe in. Well, it couldn't be a truer statement, especially for me. I didn't believe it would change my life because I really believed it would change my life. You couldn't have kept me from doing it. My history proves if I believe in something, I'm pretty much willing to die for it. But I didn't believe in what you were offering me, or I would have gave myself to it. And if you're struggling with the steps, you're struggling with this thing. I mean, that's where I would tell you to look at. I mean, it's just you don't believe in it, and I didn't believe in it, so I balked at it. I love the fellowship. I love the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Man, I love them, and so I watched AA happen. I did the social aspect. I was a drummer. I had a sober band called Alliance. It was awesome. Killer band, so much fun. Played on sober softball teams, went to sober float trips, sober dances, chased sober girls, did all the stuff, the social aspect of it. And I don't want to water that down or muddy it down or downplay it because it saved my life. But it didn't transform my life. What transformed my life would be this design for living we call the 12 steps of recovery. And but it was a challenge to get there. I grinded it out for 3 years. I don't know how I stayed. Seriously, I don't know how I stayed. I guess all the involvement I had a lot of relationships that kept me connected, but I didn't have a sponsor. I was on step zero and I was just dragging along in this thing. But eventually, after 3 years of sobriety, I finally asked for help. And it was a guy who lived down the street from me. His name was Roy. Roy passed away in October. Roy died with 49 years of sobriety, and I had the privilege to officiate his funeral. It was quite an honor to do that. And I was pretty humbled by it. Be asked to do that for a guy who ultimately saved my life. But I went to this house, Roy's house. I could walk to his house. It's one of the main reasons I asked him because I didn't have a car, I didn't have a license. So I walked to his house and he was 13 years sober. I was 3 years sober. And I remember sitting at his table like it was yesterday. I sat at him and looked across the table at me. And he says, "Harold, you've been sober now about 3 years. Tell me about your life." And I said, "I'll tell you about my life. We're on 25 years, I'm in 25 years old, going on 26. I don't have an education. I don't even have a GED. I have a criminal record. I don't have a license, and I probably never will the rest of my life. I live in a beat up old house up the street in the basement. I got a piece of crap car held together by bumper stickers that I can't legally drive, but I do anyway. I said, my life sucks, Roy. Just take the word sucks, big bold letters, highlight it, italicize it, make a neon sign out of it. That was my life. And he listened very gracefully, and he was known not to be the most gentle or graceful person there was, but he was very graceful with me that day. And he said, well, Harold, I'll be the first one to admit you've been dealt a pretty tough hand, but I hope you're going to hear what I'm going to tell you. That everything you have in your life, you have at this moment sitting at my table, you have in your life because of who you become. You've attracted it to you, just like a magnet. And the day you're man enough to own that truth is the day you're on your way to some real change. But until you can own that truth, this vicious cycle you're on, you're eventually going to drink again because you're not happy about your sobriety. Are you going to do what my dad did? My dad was an alcoholic. He never got sober that I know of. But at age 54, he took his life. That's how my dad ended the pain and the madness inside his mind. He just took his life at age 54. So you're going to do one or two things, man. You're either going to grow or you're going to go. And the million-dollar question is, what do you want to do? And so that was my first introduction to sponsorship. And that guy taught me so much. But I don't have time to get into all the things where I could just sit and talk about Roy all morning. But I will tell you a couple of things. He taught me the value of sponsorship, and he taught me the value of time, somebody else's time. On page 96, the first full paragraph is a term I use all the time. I call it 96 and sponsees. Or prospects. And I don't like using that method, but sometimes you have to be 96th. And that's, people will call, what do you think I should do? I think you should 96 the guy at this moment. And I have them read it, have them read that first full paragraph and then ask, how does that apply to our relationship? And one or two things happens. Either they say, well, look, I'm going to move on and do something else in sponsorship, or they're going to come in deeper and better and more committed than they ever have in their life. Well, I got 96 by Roy, and this is what it looked like. I was at his house. I walked down to his house and I poured myself a cup of coffee, which I did almost every day, sat in his house, drinking my coffee, vomiting my problems on Roy. And Roy one day says, Harold, I want you to do me a favor. I go, yes, sir. He goes, I want you to take your coffee. I want you to dump it out. And I want you to leave. I'm like, what? He goes, I want you to take your coffee, dump it out, and leave. I thought, are you messing with me? He goes, no, I'm not messing with you. I'm like, what's the deal? I'm totally in shock. I mean, literally caught off guard. He says, you're wasting my time. And he didn't say it that gently. You're wasting my time. Obviously, your time's not valuable. My time is extremely valuable. I said, what do you mean I'm wasting your time? He says, you come down here every day. You vomit all this stuff on me. I give you sound direction, direction that I've taken myself or others have taken to overcome the challenges that you're facing. And you don't do any of it. But yet you want to come down here the next day and the next day and the next week and the next month and just continue to vomit your own little drama and your self-pity and your self-loathing all over me. I'm tired of it. You're wasting my time. So just dump your coffee out and leave. So I did. It was really hard to leave. And I walked home like a little five-year-old kicking a can with my lip hanging out. Half of me wants to cry. Half of me wants to fight. And it took me 2 weeks to wrestle with that before I could finally go back and gently knock on his door. And he answered the door and he gently smiled at me. And I said, can we try this again? He says, come on in here. And it changed my life. So being 96th, in sponsorship changed my life big time. It taught me the value of time. So I honored my sponsor's time. I know his time's valuable. I know my time's valuable. And I get emotional talking about that because Roy was a big influence in my life. But through a series of compromises, and different things, and I'm not going to get into it, that's his story, not mine. I end up after 6 years of sobriety moving on to another sponsor here in St. Louis. He's passed away. All my sponsors have passed away, but Steve. So pray for Steve. But Bill was my next sponsor. And Bill P. was from Alton, Illinois, lived right across the street from St. Louis. And Bill was just an amazing guy. He came in day A. His wife was an alcoholic. He was an alcoholic. She left him with six kids to raise on his own. And he raised these six kids on his own in sobriety. And was just a heck of a dad, a heck of a man. And he taught me so much. But the main thing Bill taught me was just how to keep it simple and how to love people. Just love people. And he taught me how to face the things I thought were impossible. And one of them being right off the bat was I got a lot of breaks, and I don't have time to get on those breaks, but I got a break after I made amends to my mom when I was 3 years sober. My mom After that mends, my mom says, "Hey," she had finally made some success in her life in the insurance industry. She says, "Why don't you come and work for me?" I said, "Mom, they're not going to hire me to work for you." She worked for a big national firm, a huge firm, an international firm. So they're not going to hire me, Mom. I don't even qualify to take out the trash here. She goes, "Let me worry about that." So long story short, they agreed after three interviews to let me work for her, not for them, but for her. And after 1 year, they invited me to step in and do my own thing. And I made the most of that for a long time and had a great career with them. But I reached a point where I couldn't go any further. I had a lot of professional designations behind my name, but I didn't have a formal education. I finally hit a plateau, and HR says, "You can't go any further. You don't even have an education. How'd you even get a job here to start with?" And it was all a big laugh because, we know how I got a job there. But they said, "You're going to have a jet. You're going to have at least a GED." And I didn't have one. And my sponsor, Bill, says, "Man, you got it. Going to have to go take it." I said, "I can't pass it, Bill." He goes, "What do you mean you can't pass it?" I said, "I quit school when I was 13 years old. I don't have enough English. I don't have enough of what it takes. I've tried. I tried a couple of times while I was incarcerated. I got frustrated and I quit." He goes, "Well, then go sign up for classes." I said, "Do you want me to sign up for GED classes?" And I'm double digits sober. I'm very successful at this point. I got a family. He goes, "Yeah, I want you to sign up for GED classes." So I signed up for general. I signed up at the community college, Flow Valley Community College here in St. Louis. And I walked in my first class, and when I walked in there, they thought I was the professor. And but he pushed me and he encouraged me and he taught me how to show up to school. He says, "Don't sit in the back. You've always been a knucklehead. Your biggest problem wasn't that you didn't have the ability. Your biggest problem is that you're self-centered to the extreme. You don't have ADHD. You don't have all these other things you want to fall back on." And I'm not saying that for anybody else. This is my personal experience because that's one of the things I wanted to grab. I wanted to grab some labels and label myself incompetent to be able to do this because I suffer from all these things. He says, "Well, let's take those side effects, those, the typical outcomes of those things, and let's match it up with page 58 through 62, and let's see how those things match up." He goes, there is your problem. Why don't you sit in front of the class, respect the teacher, do the homework, ask the questions, and see what happens?" Well, I passed with flying colors and went on to get a bachelor's degree, stayed on the dean's list all the way through, sent my mom a bumper sticker that said, "Your kid made the honor roll." It was a big joke in my family for a long time. And then, I went on to get a master's degree in business and wrote a thesis for starting a business. And I've been able to do that not once, twice, but three different times in recovery. And then ultimately go on to get another master's degree and really close in hours to finishing a doctorate degree. But I can thank Bill P., my sponsor, for that inspiration, for pushing me in that direction and believing in me when I didn't believe in myself, but helped me overcome all the delusions. I would call it the delusion of impossibility that held me back for so long. He really, really helped me do that. Big time. I stayed with him until he got deathly ill, eventually passed away. But I moved on to a well-known AA member named Tom I. And Tom, has passed away now. Tom died with 65 years of sobriety from North Carolina. But Tom and I, because I got very involved in corrections, in 1990, Roy told me this. Roy was point blank. He says, "Do you want to have a storybook life?" I said, "Well, I don't even know what that means, but how can you say no to that?" He said, "Well, then you need to do two things and you need to do them well. And if you do these two things consistently all the time for the rest of your life, you will have a storybook life." And those two things were simply, number one, you always have to have a new guy you're working with. If you don't have a new guy, you stop what you're doing. You get out your rods, you get out your bait, you go fish where there's fish. Page 100, first full paragraph, really outlines that very well. Next, you need to go somewhere once a week where you don't want to end up. I don't care where it's at, but you go. And that started for me in the Skid Row mission at Harbor Light and Salvation Army here in St. Louis, Washington Street. It's Skid Row homelessness right next to a low bottom of Skid Row treatment centers you can get. And I went there every Thursday and every Saturday for 3 years from 90 to 93. It's the toughest AA I ever did in my life. Toughest AA. But in 93, I got invited to come into the Department of Corrections and start doing AA, which I thought would be an impossible feat from where I came from. But I did. I got my badge, and I've been a volunteer in corrections ever since, and mostly in maximum security prisons here in my area. And so for over 35 years, that's what I've been committed to, and it's made a huge difference in my life. And Roy really helped give me that foundation. But through that work in corrections and in all the stuff we did with it, I got paired with Tom a lot in corrections conferences or doing correction workshops or those type of things. And we just became instantly friends. And when Bill got really ill, was on the verge of needing a lung transplant and just about death, I was with Tom in Las Vegas. We were doing a corrections workshop together, and that's when I asked him if he I could go on this journey with him, and he agreed to that. And when this is what Tom told me, he says, he had a rule for long distance sponsorship. You had to have at least 15 years, which I qualified at that time, or was getting close to it. And secondly, you had to you had to have a check-in date every week. So that was Tuesdays at 7:30 in the morning was my check-in time. And I had to give him my wife's phone number and my kid's phone number, everybody else's, because his basic line was to me, "You're going to give me these numbers because I feel like if full transparency and accountability isn't happening, you're giving me permission to go around you to these people now. Can we agree with that?" I said, "Yes, sir." And so again, it brought a level of respect out of me for my mentors, my sponsors, as far as their time, but also their instructions to me. I hold very valuable. So when a sponsor says, "Here's what I want you to do," I may wrestle with it, but I'm going to go do it because out of respect for them. But also out of respect for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know because I've done it for so many years that it's going to make a difference in how my life turns out. So that's how Tom and I got together. And we worked together for a long time. He helped me become a Three Legacy AA member. And if you don't know what Three Legacy is, get with your sponsor, get with your home group, and you need to know what that term means. I would really encourage you to be a part of a Three Legacy home group and have a Three Legacy sponsor, somebody who really values and is committed to all three sides of our triangle, the unity, the service, and the recovery. He helped me to do that, take me through the concepts and traditions, all those things. And we collaborated on so many things together. It was a beautiful ride. I loved him dearly, but he got Alzheimer's and he got dementia. And if you've ever had to walk through that with somebody, it's brutal. But especially somebody that is a teacher, is a guide to you, to watch them suffer and eventually expire was hard. And so when he got diagnosed, and we were together doing Three Legacy workshops actually at the time, when I really noticed it, I noticed a shift in him and I noticed the decline in his mind and his life. And so I got, I knew what was going to happen. I knew where it was going. So immediately I'm in prayer. I'm in discernment. I'm like, I gotta have a different sponsor, but who am I going to get? And without it, every prayer, everything I led to led to seed. And so I didn't sit there and beat it to death. I just said I called Steve, and I asked him if he would go on this journey, and he kind of balked at it for a moment, but and just, I think just because we were friends, we've been friends for a long time. But he agreed to go on that journey. We've been on that journey for double digit years now. And so I'm grateful for Steve and Steve and I, our time, again, I just gave him what I, where I came from. And he said, "Well, I can work with that." And Fridays it's 7:30 is our time. We don't, if we don't hit that, we'll make up time. And if I need Steve for anything, I can just text him and he's and can I call you? And he's calling me and he's helped me. He's helped my wife. He's helped us as a couple do many, many things. But that journey is something that I respect. And why did I ask Steve? I mean, Steve, I had 2 years more sobriety than Steve. But the reason I think I was led to ask Steve is one, he's 10 years older than me. We were in the same kind of industry in the world of sales and we were deep in recovery, doing all kinds of things. He was married. He had a daughter. I had two daughters. And then I had two more stepdaughters and a stepson. So he just had a lot of experience, strength, and hope. I knew his lineage. I knew where he came from. His sponsor at the time, Don, was a great friend of mine and another mentor of mine. And then on down the line, Bob B, who's sponsored several guys on here, was a dear friend of mine, still is today, and an influencer in my life. So all those connections. He's only a few hours from me in drive time. So all those things really led me to Steve and why I connected with him. And I've never doubted that journey since. So we've had a lot of fun doing a lot of things throughout our sobriety. And so I'm grateful for him. I'm glad that he's on this call today. But so that's that's really my journey with sponsorship, how I went from one sponsor to the next. like I said, Roy's passed on, Bill's passed on, Tom's passed on. And it's an amazing lineage of sponsorship. You know, we can all trace our legacy back to just a few players in recovery. Bill, Bob, Clarence, if you want to go that direction. But we can all trace our roots back to the very beginning. And what's amazing, and I think sometimes we don't even think about this, you know, but if you study theology, you study religion, you study world history, you study American history, when you're studying people, a certain segment of people, typically you're looking at the first century of those people, the first, second, third, or fourth century of that movement to really learn what was their values, what were their principles, where did they come from? Well, if you have never thought about it yet, you are a first century AA member. And I think that's pretty fascinating. We're only 91 years old, and that seems like a long time, but it's really not, you know, in the big construct of things. Will AA survive all the challenges ahead? Who knows? I mean, I believe it's God orchestrated. I believe if we're good stewards of this thing, if we deliver an adequate demonstration, if we hold true to all three sides of that triangle, then I have no doubt that AA will thrive and continue to be what it is. And my sponsor, Tom, his biggest thing, I guess I guarantee the last 20 years of his sobriety was his biggest, if he had an agenda, if there was such a thing, he would, his, if he had an argument or if he had a concern or a fear about the welfare or the future of Alcoholics Anonymous, it would be this. The biggest threat to Alcoholics Anonymous in Tom's version would be the lack of three legacy AA groups. That would be the biggest threat. And I think that's true. I mean, in my 39 plus years of sobriety, you know, I've been to a lot of places. Now, some people will make the statement, I've never been to, you know, a bad meeting. Man, I've been to meetings you couldn't pay me to go back to. I don't even know if they were Alcoholics Anonymous. AA might have stood for Anything's Anonymous, but they sure weren't three legacy and they weren't on fire, because if something's on fire, people want to watch it burn. Right. And I hope your home group's on fire. My home group, A on the Rocks, on fire. If you come to it, you feel the heat. It's awesome. It's energetic. It's full of enthusiasm. It's passionate, very committed to all three legacies. I wouldn't want to be anywhere else on a Wednesday night. But being involved in that, I think, is our biggest challenge. But I'm grateful that I was sponsored in a way that I was taught to value those things. Do I do them perfectly? No, I've broken every tradition there was at some point in my life, I promise you. And the concepts were something I didn't really care about. You know, they sounded too much like, you know, a parole violation or some kind of violation being read to me when I read them. But I learned to read them, I learned to study them, I learned to respect them. I learned to support our trusted servants that serve in those positions in our group, in our district, in our area today. And I'm forever grateful for that, you know, as we move into this. But this one alcoholic talking to another, that have the language of the heart, it, you know, is the greatest gift that we have. You know, we were pulled out of the pit of alcoholism. Somebody came, his name was Gary. He came to that pit and he threw a rope down to that pit. And he jiggled the rope and just hollered down, "Do you want out of the pit?" Most of the people around me said, "No, thanks." Or, "We got it. We'll get out when we're ready to get out." Or, "We got a different way to get out of here." Whatever. But at that moment in time, I was so desperate. I was so lost. I had no other ideas. I had no other hope. And I grabbed a hold of that rope and he pulled me out of that ditch, out of that hole. And not only did he pull me out of that pit, he didn't just pull me out and leave me standing there. He walked with me, shoulder to shoulder, to help me start the journey of recreating my life, rediscovering my life, one day at a time, one week at a time, one month at a time, one year at a time. It's a long, long walk from that pit where I got out of to today. But the instruction I was given, what am I supposed to do now? What purpose is there for my life? They simply threw me the rope and they said, "You need to go back to the pits that exist all around you." And as page 152 would say, where am I going to find these people? High and low, rich and poor, you're going to find these people, future fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous, people around you, not suffering is the language they use, but they're dying. Dying. It's a big word. It's a big responsibility when you really think about it, when you frame it in that context, that here I am sitting on a Zoom meeting on Labor Day with a lot of friends from all over the place. Sober. I got my family's coming over here in a little bit. Kids are coming over to eat some barbecue. You know, I have a sober house, a sober life. My life's on fire. I wouldn't trade it for anything. Does it have some rust? Sure. I mean, if you take my life and put it like a stock index, say an S&P 500 from 1925 until today. It's up. My life has been a good run. Is there a few recessions? Sure, there has been. I don't have time to get into all those, but if it wasn't for sponsorship, I would have never made it through any of them. My sponsor, I need somebody today who's not emotionally or financially invested in my deal to help me see things as they truly are. Self's always going to be there. You're never going to fully eradicate self. It's there. It no matter what's going on, even in my spiritual walk, even if I want to dress it up in spirituality, self is still there operating. And you need a sponsor who can just take that spotlight of truth and put it on it and help you see it. And that's what Steve does for me. And Steve does it in a very delicate way. He's a very humble guy. He's very sarcastic and fun. And he's self-deprecating, which I really love. He's always throwing on himself. But he's got a way of just bringing it out and just makes sense to me. And he didn't really have to tell me what to do. He just shares some wisdom. And in that wisdom is the clear-cut directions on what I'm supposed to do next, the next steps that I'm supposed to take. And so I'm forever grateful for sponsorship. I had the privilege of sponsoring, I don't know, people ask that all the time, how many guys you sponsor? My answer is however many call me that day. My great grand sponsor, he might even catch him at the right time, might tell you it's none of your business. But I don't know how many people call me that day. I don't think I'm spread too thin. I think if somebody calls me for there's a reason why they're calling me and I need to take it seriously, and I may not be the best fit for them at that moment, but if not, I'm a bridge. I could help bridge that gap. I'm in confined spaces every week, multiple times each week. So I'm in front of newcomers a lot. So I'm constantly connecting people with sponsorship all over the place. And so it's a beautiful thing. But this one alcoholic talking to another. Now I'm going to wrap up with this story. If you're new, you'll get this. But I had a guy who got out of prison. His name was Randall. Randall was 90 days sober when he got out of prison. He wasn't in my prison. He just called me because someone referred it to him. And he said, "Hey, my name's Randall, and I just got out of prison." And they said, "You might be a good sponsor." And I said, "All right, I'll come over and pick you up." And I told my secretary, Sarah, I'm going to go pick up new guy Randall. And I went and picked him up, had his prison issue glasses, probably weighed a buck 40 in weight. And we got in and we started doing this deal. And I already had him a job. I said, "Well," because he was unemployed, didn't have a license yet. I said, "I got you a job." He goes, "Doing what?" I said, "Making bagels." He goes, "Really? Well, what's it pay?" I said, "It pays $6 an hour." He goes, "Wow." He goes, "I don't know if I can work for $6 an hour." And I said, "Well, how much are you making now?" He says, "Nothing." I said, "Well, it sounds like a $6 an hour raise." And he laughed. He goes, "Man, you got me." And so he took the job. And then right when that happened, it was our Veiled Prophet Fair in St. Louis. And I sponsored a guy who was in charge of all the entertainment for this big thing that they do in St. Louis. So I called him. His name is Chris. And I said, "Chris, we're coming down, bringing a new guy. We're going to come down to the Veiled Prophet Fair. Who's playing today? Hootie and the Blowfish." I said, "Awesome." He said, "Just look me up when you get here. I'll hook you up." So we get there, and he's like, "Hey, man, the air show is still an hour behind. So how would you guys like to go up and hang out with Darius and the guys and what? And Hootie and the Blowfish and watch the air show before they perform?" I said, "No brainer for me." And we're sitting up there and to see the look on this young man's face, 90 days sober, just out of the penitentiary, talking to Darius, hanging out with us. He looks at me and goes, "How is this possible?" And I said, "Man, every day in the world of Alcoholics Anonymous, the impossible becomes possible." And just a couple of days later, I sponsored a kidney doctor, a big long name, and I don't know the whole name, but he was on the Impaired Physicians Program, and he could not. As he's working with alcoholics, a lot of them are alcoholics, their kidneys are failing. He couldn't break his anonymity because for a lot of reasons, but he would call and say, "Hey, I got a guy." And I took Randall up with me one day. I said, "We're going to go up and see this guy." And we walked down here, and this is what I'll wrap up with. And this is really the purpose of sponsorship. This is why we do what we do. It's our primary purpose. We walked down to this room. You go in, and there's a guy in his late 30s. His belly's blown out. His kidneys are failing. His eyes are yellow. His skin is yellow. He's close to death. We walk in, his dad's sitting here like this, and he's not happy about being there. His mom's a frantic mess. And we just do what our book says. "Hey, we need to meet with your son alone, so we're going to ask you to step out." And they step out, and we do what we do. We share the language of the heart. We share what we see, what we heard, what we experienced. But within no time, we're laughing. We're getting hooked up with some guys in Cape Girardeau, where he's from. We gave him a book. And when we leave, it's like everybody had their ears on the door, listening intently, and they all just kind of fell in. They were trying to earshot on us. And as we're walking away, they thanked us. But as we walk away, a nurse practitioner walked up to us and she stopped us and she goes, "How did you guys do that?" I said, "How'd we do what?" She goes, "How did you get that guy to do what you did?" I said, "What do you mean?" She goes, "He's been here almost 3 weeks, won't talk to anybody. You guys walk in, complete strangers, within 30 minutes, he's laughing. We can hear you guys in there laughing, cutting up." I said, "Well, no, no, No cockiness, no nothing. It's just that we speak the language of the heart. Something you can't get in a university, you can't sit it, you can't get it. You have to experience it. We've experienced it. We've recovered from it. We've rediscovered life. It's not just good news. It's the best news ever, and that's what we have. She goes, "Well, it's wonderful." I said, "Yeah, it's a pretty beautiful thing." And this guy looking at me, this guy looking at me said, "That's what the language of the heart is." I said, "Amen. That's what the language of the heart is." So I'm grateful. I've experienced the language of the heart. I'm going to hear a lot more of it today. Thank you for having me. That's all I got.